The Orange FM.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Bad Wolf Radio, a discussion and review podcast all about Doctor Who. I am one of your hosts, Aaron Goins, and I'm here with the man who is still trying to perfect the Ian Chesterton sleeper thumb, Adam Farmer.
Yes, yes I am. That is one of the sweetest moves I've seen pulled off in Doctor Who, and I am definitely looking to figure out how Ian pulls it off.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to me that a teacher knows how to do such things, but I guess we'll get into that discussion when we're actually talking about the Aztec episodes later on.
Yeah, I mean, there's some rumors going around that Ian might have some special forces training.
Yes, so but before we do that, we need to introduce our very first ever guest on Bad Wolf Radio. We wanted to throw in a third person into the mix, and I have a friend who is a big Doctor Who fan, and I wanted to add her in and get her take on some of this stuff. So her name is Amy Radcliffe. How are you doing today, Amy?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me to chat Doctor Who.
No problem at all. Really excited to have you on. Amy is actually a kind of a writer, blogger. She writes for a number of sites right now. What are a couple of the sites that you write for, Amy?
I write for Nerdist, IGN, and StarWars.com.
Wow. So that's awesome. Those three sites that I frequent quite a bit.
Well, excellent. Keep clicking. it helps it all out.
But before we get into any of the discussion, we did want to ask you a few questions, kind of get a feel for your personal Doctor Who fandom. So what...
And nobody's going to judge, right?
No,
no
not
judgment
at all.
Here. Okay. Absolutely okay. No judgment.
We're both kind of newer to the Doctor Who fandom. You know, we got started on the new Doctors, so we've watched all of that stuff. But, you know, we've dabbled a little bit in the classic stuff as well. But neither of us are, you know, experts on Doctor Who. And we know that a lot of people are kind of more recent fans. And I think you kind of are more of a recent fan. When did you start watching Doctor Who?
I started watching, I think it was around... 6 or so years ago. So I didn't start watching live until the Matt Smith years.
Okay.
Maybe so, even the second season. So yeah, I started watching somewhere in David Tennant's run.
So you've been watching it longer than I have. I didn't start until after Tennant had left. And then I went back and started with Eccleston stuff. But yeah, so I didn't get started until after 2010. So you're more of a veteran in Doctor Who than I am.
Well, But I've still only seen the modern series, though, as well.
So I know a lot of Doctor Who fans kind of get talked into watching Doctor Who by, like, a friend or something like that. Like, did you have, you know, was it something that you found on your own, or did you have a friend kind of push you into it?
You know, I will say one thing about, like, I've seen about Doctor Who fandom, and it's good and bad, but the bad side I've seen is Doctor Who fans, like, they'll, like, kind of browbeat you into watching the show. So eventually you're like, fine. Like, I will watch it just so you will get off my back so I don't have to have another conversation with you about why I'm not watching this show next time I see you. But I noticed that it's just a really interesting dynamic I've seen. But it was kind of a combination of just everyone around me seemed to be watching it. And this one guy in particular, a friend, just kept kind of bugging me about it. And he's like, you need to watch Blink. And that was ended up being the first thing I watched. And he just hammered it over and over that it was more of a frustration, like, fine, like, I will check it out, just leave me alone. And then I liked it, so I had to thank him and apologize for being mean.
That's awesome. That's a great story. But yeah, definitely, I can definitely see how the feeling of Doctor Who fans. I think Aaron kind of had that effect on me as well. I kept on bringing up this whole BBC TV show that I had to watch, so I'm right there with you, Amy.
Yeah, I got bullied into Doctor Who a little bit.
Nice. So the typical question, everybody has their doctor. So this is probably the biggest question. Take some time to think through it. But who is your doctor?
No thinking required, Matt Smith. And even though he wasn't, because Christopher, I mean, he wasn't, like, I watched David Tennant that one episode, and then I'm like, look, I'm going to go back and watch Eccleston. And I like Tennant a lot. I mean, he's charming, and his doctor had a lot of depth and a lot of, like, goofiness and this great balance. But from the, like, second Matt Smith said Geronimo, I'm like, this is my guy. I just knew.
So I'm curious because I know me and Adam both are more fans of Tennant's run of, as the Doctor. So what about Smith did you like more than the other two? What about that the way he played the Doctor?
I think the first time I really like kind of, I mean, I was hooked from the beginning, but when I really saw what he could do, was at the beginning, or I'm sorry, rather the end of the 11th Hour, his first episode, when he faces down the Atraxi and has that great monologue and tells them to run. And because I was hesitant because he's so young and, you know, he's the youngest person that's ever played the Doctor, but he had that kind of weight and weariness in his eye, kind of a presence and command. And kind of that balance with his youth and silliness, like I didn't feel like we'd had quite that mixture in any other, well, any of the other doctors I'd seen. So that appealed to me.
Yeah, that's a the 11th Hour is maybe my favorite episode of all of Doctor Who. Even though it doesn't have my favorite Doctor, that is one of the best episodes. So I can see where you're coming from. So, favorite companion, and you can include, you know, maybe not the main companions, but even, you know, a recurring character. Who's kind of your favorite character other than the Doctor?
I have to say, Donna Noble.
Another unique answer.
I was gonna say we're this is completely different than what I'm used to, so this is awesome.
Yeah, that's why I warned you, like, not to judge, because like I can't stand Rose, and people get upset with me about that. But I thought Donna was really cool because she very much, I mean, because you know Rose and the Doctor had that whole weird love angle. And even though Martha was really cool and very capable, she kind of sometimes seemed like she was a little desperate to like get, not get in the Doctor's pants, but to like, to make, like to be in love with him or to have a relationship. And but then Donna came along and she's all like, look, we're friends, like this, nothing else is happening. And she wasn't afraid to sass him back and kind of, she wasn't afraid to push him into, you know, the right decision or call him out when he was being stupid. And I really like that brashness and that kind of just, she wasn't taking any crap from him.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you. I think she was a great character, and I did like her time as a companion, but she did take a little getting used to. The kind of her personality was a little abrasive, and it was kind of so different than what we were used to that, you know, for me it was kind of something I had to adjust to, but by the time I adjusted, I really enjoyed her on the show.
She's a lot to take. She was really pretty annoying in The Runaway Bride.
Yeah, and my wife loved her. My wife loved that character and would crack up every time, you know, she would say anything pretty much. So I enjoyed watching my wife enjoy it. So that made me like the character even more.
That's really interesting though, because it's like what you said as far as you had Rose and then you had Donna, and then we kind of have the same thing because then you had Amy and then you had Clara, and it seems like you have the one companion who is, I guess, somewhat of the love interest, if you will. And then you do have someone like Donna who comes in and more of the Doctor's equal, kind of like what Clara was for Matt Smith. So yeah, that makes perfect sense. I can see why Donna would kind of stick out to you like that. That's an awesome explanation. So next question. Favorite or which villain slash monster when you close your eyes do you find yourself haunted by when it comes to Doctor Who?
You know, I kind of spoiled myself from the get-go because I saw Blink and the Weeping Angels until Moffat or whoever kind of overused them, which I have feelings about that I won't go into here. But the first time I saw that, those things scared the crap out of me. I looked sideways, anytime I was near a cemetery with, like, they really got under my skin to the point where I saw one at a convention not too long after I started watching Doctor Who. I walked the opposite way. Like, I'm not going anywhere near somebody dressed as a weeping angel. But then it was like after that, because that's one of the things I'd heard about Doctor Who, you know, it was a little scary. But seeing weeping angels first and then jumping to Eccleston, where the first bad villain thing is plastic mannequins, like I kind of went backwards. To me, the weeping angel's been the scariest thing I've seen. The silence are up there too.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I even if it's just one of those little cherub statues, I still have to kind of like keep one eye open on it just in case something might happen, especially after the whole Rory incident. But that's another story.
Oh yeah, it is.
So you brought up someone cosplaying as a weeping angel at a convention. I know you yourself are a bit of a cosplayer. Have you ever cosplayed as a Doctor Who character?
Close. I did like an Amy Pond inspired costume, just because she always kind of has that iconic like short shorts, like combat-y sort of boots and tights, and the flannel shirt, well, flannel or plaid shirt that she wore in series 5. So I kind of did loosely based on Amy Pond. I would love to have. I've noticed Think Geek has put out coats for like cut for ladies for the 10th and 11th doctors, and I'd love to get one of those and do a Tennant or Matt Smith crossplay one of these days.
Final question: if you have a friend that you're trying to bully into watching Doctor Who and they tell you, okay, I'm gonna watch 3 episodes and that's it, and if I'm not hooked, I'm never gonna watch the show again, what 3 episodes do you tell them to watch?
The first one I showed my sister, or the first Smith episode anyway, it's Vincent and the Doctor. And I would recommend that one.
Awesome.
Because it has, yeah, it just has a nice tight of history, has a really moving story, and a cool monster, I think. So I think it has a little bit of everything. And for a fun episode that kind of shows people like the wacky things you can get into on Doctor Who, the Shakespeare Code. It's kind of, maybe I just like period, but it's another example of travel back through time. Like, I loved all the stuff with Shakespeare and the Harry Potter reference and Queen Elizabeth showing up at the end. And I think that episode was just a lot of fun. And the third one, can I count a two-parter for my third one?
Sure.
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of two-parters.
Okay. I do the Empty Child and the Doctor Dances.
Rose, I've just remembered.
What?
I can dance.
Actually, Doctor, I thought Jack might like this dance.
I'm sure he would, Rose. I'm absolutely certain. But who with?
Awesome.
Just, yeah, I don't think Eccleston gets near enough love. And those two episodes together, oh my goodness, they kill. Just even thinking about his speech and, it makes me teary-eyed just thinking about it. I feel like those are a really powerful couple of episodes that I think communicate like the what the Doctor is capable of and kind of some of the stuff he's gone through and how he sees Earth and the galaxy. And so those are my three.
I like how you included all three Doctors. That was nice.
I tried to balance it.
Yeah. But I agree with at least the first two. Actually, I'm trying to remember what the Eccleston episode you're referring to. I'm not remembering what exactly
Mummy.
Those were.
Mummy.
Is that the ones with the gas masks
yes.
and all that stuff? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, those are the episodes that actually got me hooked. It was up until that point, I was still kind of iffy about the show. And then once I hit those episodes, I was like, all right, I'm in.
Those are like bedrock of Eccleston right there, because it really... Like, I remember where I was, what I was doing when I watched those episodes, and just that eerie feeling of expecting someone to sneak up behind me and say, Mummy, Mummy, freaked me out. Those are some great episodes.
Well, thanks for letting us interview you really quickly, but we will now move into our news and discussion topics, and we have something pretty exciting that has been revealed. And I'm sure you guys have seen it, but it looks like we may have a new companion that we already know about before the season even starts airing. Did you guys catch this news that came across?
Absolutely. I was right on top of that. I was so excited to see that come through. It's like the rumor mills over the past week have finally started to grind out some news, and it has been fun to read.
It was good to see this was officially announced by BBC as well. So it's not just some, you know, some set pictures or something like that. You know, there's actually been an official casting announcement. So yeah, I'm pretty excited as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how he'll fit in with the group.
Definitely.
So yeah. Now we don't really know, like, we don't know when he's going to show up. Is that correct? Like, we know that he is going to be in series 8, but we don't know when he'll be introduced. Is that right?
Right. So what we do know, I'll kind of just run down a little bit. The actor's name is Samuel Anderson, and he's going to be playing a character by the name of Danny Pink.
Stop right there. What do you think of the name?
Danny Pink?
Yes, Danny Pink. Is it a name that sticks with you?
It's one of those names, I guess, that kind of works for Doctor Who. You know, Doctor Who typically likes to use very short names and memorable names, you know, Amy Pond or Rose Tyler. So Danny Pink just kind of seems to fit, although it is kind of a little bit of a goofy sounding name, I guess. And especially when you look at the guy, he doesn't look like somebody who would have the last name Pink.
Okay, you can continue. I just wanted to ask.
Did you have an opinion on the name, Amy?
It seems very much like a pen name. Like, he was an actor, or he's going to be an actor, and is changing his name to something that people will not forget. So I think it's borderline silly, but it's Doctor Who, so it kind of works.
Yeah, we're used to borderline silly.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Or over the line silly. But so basically what we know about the character is that he's going to be a teacher at Coal Hill School with Clara. And at some point he's going to join them. So I think that's pretty much all we know officially. There may be more rumors out there or leaked stuff that I'm not aware of. But officially, I think that's what we know. And it's interesting because, you know, Coal Hill School is the school that, you know, the characters that we just watched the episodes from the first Doctor, Ian Chesterton and Barbara Wright, were teachers there as well. So it's kind of cool to see them tying, you know, this series, the modern series, back into the first season like that.
Yeah, I mean, we have Moffat kind of tying the stories together, interweaving the Doctor Who universe together. I'm excited. I really am excited to see who this character is and kind of what this character becomes. Will Danny Pink stick around longer than Clara does? Will Clara slowly drift away, and yet Danny Pink is going to be the one that travels with the Doctor from this point forward? Really, really interested to see what happens here.
Yeah, so when they cast Peter Capaldi, one of the things that I kind of was wondering if they would do, because now you're losing the Matt Smith factor, which is kind of the young, you know, attractive man that brings in a lot of the female viewers. I know not all female viewers watch Doctor Who because of the cute guys, but there's definitely some that do. And so I wondered if they would kind of bring in, you know, a younger male companion to kind of offset that. So the fact, you know, they have brought in that character, so it doesn't really surprise me. But I'm wondering if he's going to be kind of like the new, like, Ricky or not Ricky, Mickey. I guess there was a Ricky.
Maybe he'll be like Jack.
Yeah, like the new Mickey or Rory, I guess, kind of where he's like kind of there along for the ride sometimes, but maybe other times he's not. But he's not really, you know, Clara would still kind of be the main companion. So I wonder how often we'll see him.
Yeah, how regular he'll be.
See, I'm kind of hoping, kind of for what Amy said, like, maybe he will be the new Jack. Maybe he's just going to be a guy who kind of jumps on board. He's not fazed by anything. And he kind of just runs with it. I would much rather see kind of like that personality from a character, not so much of the Mickey / Ricky or the Rory, but someone who really just kind of takes it in strides and really helps to balance out the Doctor. I think having another Jack character who just kind of is like, okay, whatever, this is what I do, this is who I am, just roll with it. I think that would be an awesome dynamic, especially with Capaldi, not knowing what Capaldi's going to be like. Maybe we're going to have a Sherlock Watson kind of dynamic there.
Oh, I guess I hate it behind that.
The only difference would be Jack was a time traveler, and this guy's just a school teacher. So
we, for now, right. We don't know.
It may take him some time to adjust, but and that's typical for a companion, is to have kind of that character arc. You know, even Mickey and Rory both kind of came in as these almost bumbling idiots a little bit, and then their character arcs brought them into being much more, you know, confident characters by the end of their run. So this guy coming in the door may start out a little bit less confident, but maybe reach the status of Jack eventually. But I doubt he'll be that right off the bat.
I'm just going to say, have you looked at Danny Pink's coat? I haven't seen many school teachers rocking that look. So
hey, I'm with you. I actually, that was one of the first things I noticed about him was his awesome coat and how he had the popped collar. And he does look very confident. You know, he's got his arms crossed. So
I'm kind of waiting for them to kind of mash all these character pictures together into a sweet Doctor Who poster, because you have Capaldi in the middle with his hands like outstretched, and then you have Danny Pink on the left side of him. Now we just need someone turned the opposite direction to have a pretty sweet Doctor Who poster.
Maybe that's what they're building to.
Yeah, that was going to say, maybe you called it right there, Adam, that because all of these pictures they're revealing have a complete white background. So it does seem like they're almost cut out of something bigger.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe,
but the Doctor Who characters typically do dress pretty nice. So this guy's definitely got some style. Gotta give him that.
Speaking of style, I just want to throw this out there because I know that we talked a lot about Capaldi's outfit, but there has been a picture that surfaced here recently of a possible second outfit for Capaldi. I don't know if you guys got to see that picture, but just. Any thoughts on the Doctor wearing a jumper / sweater? Does that strike you as kind of odd?
It just by itself, it does. Like if it was more of a sweater or something like over a collared shirt, like I would like that look better than just the sweater and the coat. That does strike me as it looks a little untidy for the Doctor, because the Doctor's usually pretty, I mean, he can be rumply and scruffy, but he's usually pretty put together. And the jumper doesn't do it for me.
I agree.
I kind of feel like he's going to like an ugly Christmas sweater party, or he's like somebody's dad that you might walk into just to say hi and move on from there. But anyways, I thought that was an interesting picture.
I actually haven't even seen this picture, but just the way you're describing it, I couldn't imagine that the Doctor would have that as a regular outfit. You know, the sweater look, the whole Mr. Rogers, you know, that it's just not the Doctor style, so that would shock me.
Anyways,
plus
we can.
It looks like it's bedazzled.
It does. And it throws me off. It's like it's a starry background or something like that on his on his sweater.
So where's this image from? Is it just like some kind of, you know, set picture, or?
From the looks of it and just kind of the story associated with it, it looks like someone happened across filming and they just had a chance photo op with Capaldi.
Yeah, and they tweeted it.
Maybe he threw a sweater on because he was cold or something. So something that came along with the news of the new companion is some rumors that Peter Capaldi could be the Doctor for only one season. So, and I kind of... You know, these are the type of rumors that there's really not a lot of basis for them. So it's more an excuse for us to speculate or talk about what we would think about there only being one season of this new Doctor, more than us actually taking the rumor that seriously. But what would you guys think if we had another kind of Christopher Eccleston type thing where he's one and done?
I think we've been kind of spoiled because we had Tennant and Smith for so long compared to Eccleston. So just from a formatting standpoint, I think it would be neat to see it change. But by the same token, man, I would have loved to see more of Eccleston. He barely got time to sink his teeth in and what he showed us. I mean, granted, it comes from where the Doctor was in that time too, where he was, you know, after Gallifrey, but you know, he really is such a different doctor than anything we've seen. And I wanted more time with him. So if he would have had even longer to develop it, like what, think about the possibility. So I don't know if a year is long enough to find your footing as the doctor. So I hope it is not true.
I'm kind of right there with Amy. It's one of those things with just how the seasons have been here recently and kind of the storyteller that Moffat is. It seems like you definitely need a little bit more than just one season to kind of become the doctor that you want to be, especially if you're throwing in a new companion. As unsure as I am about Capaldi right now, I'm not going to say that I want to see him for only one season. I definitely would prefer to see him for more than that. It would be really sad if he went the way of Eccleston.
Yeah, I completely agree with both of you. I hope they give him at least a couple seasons to, like Amy said, to get his footing. And I can't agree more with Amy as far as we didn't get enough time with Eccleston. And I think Adam would agree as well. You know, we would have loved to see him stick around longer as well. So I don't want that to happen again with Capaldi. I think one of the things that is kind of going around as well is the fact that, you know, the whole idea that Moffat may be leaving Doctor Who pretty soon because of his work on Sherlock and that kind of stuff. So I guess maybe that's kind of the thought process, is if he only stays around for one more season, chances are if they change the showrunner, then they'll change the Doctor as well. So I think maybe that's kind of what's starting these rumors.
Yeah, which we talked a little bit about that last show, how a lot of that could just be trying to grab headlines or clicks for a headline. There's just been a lot of interesting news kind of swirling around that whole thing, as far as, is Moffat really just kind of prepping for the end? Is Capaldi a transition doctor because Moffat's only planning on kind of jump starting the new series and then moving on from there? It will be interesting to see. I hope they're all just rumors, especially with the way that the show has evolved and kind of it really has gotten better, I think, more polished as time has gone on. So it would be sad to see Moffat leave, and it would be really sad to see Capaldi only one season.
Yeah, so, I would be sad about Capaldi. I'd be less, I don't want to start an argument, but I would be less sad about Moffat moving on.
Really?
Oh, no argument. I just want to know why.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell us more.
I feel like he has kind of some standard go-tos. And when he, you know, when Russell Davies was running things, like Moffat did plant a lot of interesting information that came up later with Silence in the Library, for example. But now that he's kind of in charge, he does things like turn the Statue of Liberty into a Weeping Angel for like the special blockbuster effect. So kind of that stuff, and just kind of the stuff that feels like forced, like the Christmas special this year, I didn't love.
I'm with you on that.
Until the end. It feels like a lot of it's for show, and it's a lot of setting things up, like very, just to show. I mean, it is that he is clever, but I feel like he does a lot of, look how clever I am. Like, I want you to appreciate it. And sometimes that overrules good or practical storytelling. And I don't think he has anybody to tell him no.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And I'm kind of with you. There's definitely been things about Moffat's era that I haven't really loved, and not that I want him to go, but if he did go, I wouldn't be completely heartbroken, because I'd be interested to see what somebody else could do with it.
Yeah. I mean, he's done a lot of good things. Like, I won't argue that he's done a lot of fascinating things with the Who universe. And it's certainly more, I mean, look what he's done for, while he's been involved, how the US fandom base for Doctor Who has grown. But yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing a different base in charge.
Moffat in small portions is really good. I mean, look what he's done with Sherlock. But then,
yes,
maybe as things get longer and he kind of looks how many episodes he can play with, he definitely struggles with keeping all the things put together and concise and moving in the same direction. So yeah, that makes perfect sense.
So Adam, what's this about Legos?
Okay, so I am, from a very young age, have been obsessed with Legos. and here recently. There's a pretty sweet website where users can submit ideas for future Lego sets, and they've done some really sweet things with Ghostbusters that they're looking at doing here soon. But there was just a licensing conflict lifted off of or between Lego and Doctor Who. So the big news that has kind of just hit within the last day or two is that there is a very strong potential that at some point in the future, there could be official Doctor Who Lego sets coming to stores near you, which just has me absolutely floored. It would be awesome to be able to go out and buy my daughter and my son some real Doctor Who Lego sets.
Yeah, because all they have now, it's like they're Lego-like, right? Like there's some sets, exactly.
I have them on my desk at work. I have the set of all 11 Doctors from that fake Lego stuff. I actually kind of like the style because the faces are actually molded differently. Unlike Legos, where every head is exactly the same shape, I kind of like how they're able to make them all look like the Doctor. The thing I wouldn't like about Legos is they would lose some of that ability to kind of customize the look of the character. So
yeah, their clothes could still print the blocks so the clothes look right. Because yeah. I would buy a set of Doctor Who minifigs like in a heartbeat.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna buy them.
A tiny little TARDIS set.
Yes, and if you just do a quick Google search of it, they have some pretty sweet mock-ups of the minifigs, and like they have Rory down pat with his blue puffy vest, and it's amazing how like spot on some of the minifigs that they're kind of just mocking up look. It would be really sweet to see those as I walk through the toy aisle of a store shopping for my kid's birthday or Christmas present, to be able to see those and throw them in the cart, of course, for the kids, not for myself.
I have no kids. I would totally buy them all for myself.
Yeah, I would end up stealing them and they'd be on my desk.
All right, so let's move on to our review of the classic Doctor Who episodes, and kind of just to recap what we're doing with these. We're going back to the classic Who era and reviewing all of the episodes that are available on Hulu Plus. So we started with the very first episodes. We've gotten through quite a few now, and now we are up to the Aztecs storyline. These episodes are on Hulu Plus, but they're also available on Netflix. These are the first ones that are available on Netflix. So if you don't have Hulu Plus, but you have Netflix, you can go watch these episodes and then maybe come back to the podcast and listen to us talk about them. But kind of picking up where we left off, so the last episodes we reviewed were the Edge of Destruction episodes, which was just the two episodes, and then now we're jumping to the Aztecs. So there's actually some storylines that are not available on Hulu Plus. They're not available on Netflix, so we're not able to review those. So that's, I think, the Marco Polo storyline, which isn't available anywhere because all of those episodes are missing. They've been lost in time, which is kind of sad.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's kind of sad to think that something as iconic as Doctor Who has lost entire storylines.
That's
hard to wrap my head around.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. Like in this day and age where everything is recorded and like forever saved, you know, it's just hard to imagine that there was a time where they literally would film this stuff and then throw it away. So I guess they didn't know that this was going to become such a huge thing. But apparently they're finding, you know, some of these lost episodes here and there. So maybe someday they'll find the Marco Polo episodes and we'll be able to actually watch them. But then the next storyline after Marco Polo is the Keys of Marinus. Now, I've actually watched these. I got them through the mail DVD, you know, a while back and watched through them. But those were kind of interesting, kind of like the Dalek episodes where they seem to be very repetitive and kind of boring. But then, so now we're up to where we are now, the Aztec storyline, which I think, in my opinion, this is kind of the first storyline of all the storylines that we've seen so far that I thought was actually very well done, and I actually really enjoyed it and didn't have that many complaints about it. How did you guys feel? I know, Amy, this is the first time you've watched any classic Doctor Who. How did you like the Aztec storyline?
You know, I because I've heard so much going into classic Doctor Who about like just warnings about, you know, the first Doctor's really grouchy and special effects are horrible, which they kind of are. And I just heard like you should watch it, but then followed by a list of whole reasons, like a long list of, well, don't worry about this. Like this part's not great in this part. So anyways, I wasn't super excited. And is why I've been putting off watching classic Who for a while. But people were right once again, because I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. And I really kind of, I ended up finding the first Doctor to be pretty endearing.
Yeah, it's
in a curmudgeonly way.
I'd be interested to, like, if you had watched the episodes that we've watched up until this point, if you would think the same thing about the Doctor, because literally up until the Aztec episodes, he was just a jerk.
I heard you guys saying that in your last podcast. I'm like, oh, I'm glad I didn't see that side.
Yeah, so, and there's kind of this progression. I think, you know, it may be intentional. You know, he's starting to get used to these characters and enjoy their company more. But yeah, definitely in the Aztec episodes, he was a much kinder, gentler Doctor than we had gotten so far.
This is the first episode where, kind of knowing where we've come from, it's not the Doctor that we know in the modern series still, obviously. And there was even some conversation on that on Facebook, people saying how funny it is that we look for the modern Doctor and the classic Doctor, where it should kind of be the other way around. But it was still one of those episodes where I'm starting to see traits of the Doctor. He's no longer kind of wanting to leave Barbara and Ian behind and throw them to the wolves and just let what may happen happen. He actually is starting to kind of care for or protect or try to help those that are traveling with him. So I thought it was overall a fun story. Like you said, it was probably one of the best stories that we've watched up to this point. So it was pretty good to watch through.
So as the episode opens, we get the toy model set of the TARDIS. And I know they've used this technique before in other episodes we've seen, but this one seemed to be particularly bad. The toy looked different than the ones they had used before. And so obviously it was, you know, a play set as opposed to, you know, a nice model.
Yeah, I saw that and I busted up laughing.
It's a toy that has gone through, like, it's a toy that's been chewed on by the dog a little bit, because it definitely is bumpy and really weird looking, like you said.
Yeah, it's almost like they lost the model they usually use, and they just had to throw that thing together really fast at the last minute. But yeah, so that I thought that was kind of funny, and I kind of laughed at it too. And I can only imagine, Amy, if that's your very first image of Doctor Who, how that would be kind of like, uh-oh, what am I getting myself into?
I did. It looked like a terrarium that I have seen. That's what, like it looked like somebody had set a camera. Because I've seen like a Doctor Who terrarium with the TARDIS, and I'm like, oh dear. I'm going to need another glass of wine.
As you see a turtle crawl up to it, or another little stick figure that they put in there.
Exactly.
So we get the TARDIS actually lands inside this tomb in Mexico, back in the, you know, I don't know what time period it was. I'm not that well versed in world history to know what time period they were in as far as when the Aztecs were there. Do you guys know?
Supposedly around the 15th century.
All right. History major here.
I'm also very good at Google.
But I thought it was kind of funny. They land inside this tomb, and then Susan and Barbara come out of the TARDIS and realize they're inside this grave. And then they just start kind of picking up stuff off the grave and completely defiling it. And like,
yeah, what was up with that?
I know Barbara's like putting on stuff. I'm like, man, have some respect for the dead here.
I just think it's great how like the scene opens and they basically focus in on the dead man's face. And then sure enough, they come out and they basically start picking up his jewelry and putting it on, and they don't really care. They're window shopping right now.
Yeah. And besides like just being respectful and not doing that, like you travel around, like weird stuff happens to you. Do you really think it's a good idea to walk into a grave and just put things on? Like, no, it's not something I would ever consider doing.
But then I guess Barbara gets herself captured, and then quickly the Aztecs think that she, because she's wearing that bracelet. So I guess it was kind of, you know, plot, you know, they had to have her put it on, because otherwise the Aztecs wouldn't have thought that she was the the spirit of what was it, Yataxa?
Yep.
Okay. I had such a hard time with the names in this episode because the main kind of like the bad guy, the villain, his name sounded very similar to Yataxa. It was like
Tetoxel?
Yeah, so I was like, man, I can't tell the difference between those two names. Why didn't they name him like Frank or something?
It's great though, because if you watch through the episodes again and you listen to how the characters like pronounce his name, it seems like they didn't even know what they were supposed to be calling him, because it seems like everybody else or everybody put their own little spin on what his name sounded like. I think it's Tetoxel, but it might be something entirely different.
Yeah. We should call him Frank the Aztec.
Frank the Aztec. I was just in my notes, I just kept calling him Striped Face Dude, because he had that sweet like stripe tattoo across his mouth. Which, yeah, if I thought a tattoo on my arm hurt, I can only imagine how much that tattoo hurt.
It's just a press on. Don't worry about it.
But yeah, that guy was an interesting character and definitely the most memorable, you know, villain that they've faced so far, in my opinion. I thought the actor that portrayed him, I thought did a great job of just kind of being that, you know, kind of old timey, you know, twisting your mustache type of villain.
That is like the best way to describe him, like twisting his mustache. You really expect him to be one of those old Western villains that you kind of hear the piano play the dramatic music and he kind of just jumps into the scene, twisting his mustache and getting ready to tie someone to a railroad track. But yeah, he's an interesting character. Every character, though, everybody in these episodes, be it him or Otlok, the other high priest, or even Ixta, the warrior, all of them were... I think all of them were played really well. They definitely made their parts memorable.
Yeah, and there were a lot of, like, I felt like, especially the bad guy, you know, they were kind of archetypes, but it really worked for this episode, and it made their dynamics very, very straightforward, but without being boring, if that makes sense.
Right. So basically, Barbara is now believed to be this spirit of, I guess it's a god that they have, right?
Yep.
So now everyone is kind of deferring to her, except for, you know, of Frank the Aztec, who doesn't really, you know, believe that she's the... It's not in his best interest, I think, for her to actually be the god. So he definitely is trying to disprove it. But, you know, and so she's trying to stop this, the whole idea of human sacrifice. You know, she's thinking that she can kind of change the way that these Aztecs think. And I thought it was interesting the doctor used this line. He says, "You can't rewrite history, not one line."
There'll be no sacrifice this afternoon, Doctor, or ever again. The reincarnation of Yataxa will prove to the people that you don't need to sacrifice a human being in order to make it rain.
Barbara, no.
It's no good, Doctor. My mind's made up. This is the beginning of the end of the sun god.
What are you talking about?
Oh, don't you see? If I could start the destruction of everything that's evil here, then everything that is good would survive when Cortez lands.
But you can't rewrite history. Not one line.
Which kind of flies in the face of the Doctor that, you know, kind of the current series now, because he's constantly going and changing things here and there.
That's definitely something that stuck out to me, because we're just coming off of the 50th anniversary, where basically all of history for the Doctor himself has been changed. But yet, up to that point, what the Doctor says in these episodes has really been true. Like, even Tennant would say, no, we can't change this. I mean, we talked about the fires of Pompeii a couple weeks ago, and that's kind of his entire thing from there. We can't change this. We can't change history on this point. It's a fixed point in time. But yeah, it's reminiscent of what we already know up until here recently, where basically everything's in flux and you can change whatever you want as long as you think hard enough about it.
Well, if he had left it at "you can't rewrite history," I would have been completely cool with that. But the fact that he adds the line, "not one line," so it's almost like he was saying you can't change anything, which then is kind of like, okay, in the fires of Pompeii, he didn't change the fact that Pompeii happened, but he did save a family that he probably shouldn't have saved. And And also with the whole Amy Pond thing where she, you know, she actually kind of restarts the whole universe, doesn't she, with the whole remembering the Doctor and bringing him back during her wedding. You guys remember that?
Yep.
Oh, right.
So that definitely changed history. And then with the stuff that happened in the Christmas special too. So, you know, it's just interesting, I guess. Obviously, this is 1963, and when they said that line, they weren't thinking of what Stephen Moffat was going to do with the Doctor in the 2000s. But I just thought it was kind of interesting that they've kind of fudged that rule now. They can definitely change one line.
Yeah, they kind of pick and choose, I feel like, when it's convenient for them to kind of like the Prime Directive, when it's convenient for them to change it, they find ways around it. What I did really like about that interaction, though, is especially given the time period, like Barbara's got some moxie. Like, I like that she's kind of I don't necessarily agree that she's right, but I like that she's willing to say that to the Doctor, and they were willing to include, you know, a female character in that show that stands up to a man, and especially somebody like the Doctor. I think that's pretty cool for the time period.
And kind of jumping off what Amy says, it's really interesting kind of seeing the stories that we've seen up to this point. The Doctor actually, in a way, is starting to yield to Barbara a little bit more, which I think is awesome. He actually has a little bit of respect. He kind of puts their lives in her hands throughout multiple points in this episode. Barbara is no longer the one that we saw running in fear from the cavemen in the first episode. I appreciate the fact that she definitely gets a little bit more credit now.
Yeah, she definitely plays a much stronger part in this episode than she has previously. And I enjoyed seeing that character development for her. But one thing that stuck out to me was kind of the props that they used for the episode. They actually did a really good job with at least kind of the... I thought that, like, the outfits and the weapons that they used, you know, I've seen some of those episodes of, like, Deadliest Warrior. Have you guys ever heard of that TV show?
No.
Where they, it's kind of like I think it might be a History Channel show, but they compare, you know, like ancient warriors and who would win in battle. And they go through all their weapons in detail, like what types of weapons they used and that type of thing. And I remember when they had the Aztec warriors on that show, they had these weapons that were kind of like those clubs with the stone kind of embedded in the sides. And, you know, those are the exact same type of weapons that they were using, you know, in the filming of this episode. So I thought that was kind of cool that they were pretty historically accurate as far as how the weapons looked. And considering how low budget this show sometimes seems, it was kind of nice to see that touch.
Yeah, they're obviously, I think, paying attention to the details, even though they can't necessarily, like, the quality doesn't hold up and it doesn't look, you know, like watching an episode of Doctor Who now. But yeah, I agree. I think the costumes and the makeup and all of those kind of important pieces, I think those were really well done. That was the part I was surprised by, because I was going and expecting something barely watchable. But
the one thing they didn't do so well was the scenery, which I thought, from my point of view, it looked like they had a sheet just hanging and then they painted the scenery on the sheet. Did that stick out to you guys at all?
Are you thinking specifically like when they're at the top of the temple and looking out over the village?
Yes.
Yeah, that was, and it's so sad that that's within probably the first 5 minutes of the episode and you see that right off the bat. But I mean, we are, again, the 60s. I don't know what I was expecting, but it was another one of those just comical parts of the episode.
I kind of try to think of it as like a stage play or something, you know, where, you know, they have to use those type of things. And if you kind of just don't think about it too much, it doesn't really bother you.
Exactly. Like, it's jarring at first, but then I'm like, well, you kind of like process like, oh, it is 1963, like fine, like, or 64, whenever it aired, and you move on.
So how did you feel about, because they're all in the temple and Barbara, she's Yataxa and everything's good there. And then they kind of get separated. Ian gets thrown to be the commander. And then the Doctor gets kind of sequestered to the old people garden. What did you think of that?
The old people garden cracked me up too. I was just, because it took me a second. I'm like, is this the Aztec retiree village? Like, they just kind of shuffled him over here. It was an interesting, like, it took me a second to catch up, like to what was happening, because it was just so, it just felt so weird compared to what else was going on for me.
Yeah, they've definitely focused in this series on the Doctor's age and that he's older than the rest of the people. So I thought it was kind of fitting that they did this to him. I thought it was comical as well. But it was cool because it gave us a chance to see a different side of the Doctor, because we have this character, this woman that he runs into that I think he was kind of using her in a way. But at the same time, I think there was some genuine affection, and it was kind of cool to see that type of a relationship for the Doctor, because so far in the classic series, we haven't seen that yet.
Right. I also thought it was kind of neat to kind of see him, because so far we've seen the Doctor play a secondary role to the companions, and really the companions are driving the story forward the entire time. And I kind of thought that's what was going to happen with him being in the Peace Garden by himself. And yet he's in the Peace Garden, but he's still trying to actively move the story forward, which I thought was cool, because he's kind of taking that role of scheming and thinking through things. And yeah, he gets played at one point with Old Flower and the Needle and everything like that, but he's still trying to work what he can work without having the physical abilities. I thought that was really cool to see him take that role.
And I like the line where the lady is talking to him and she says that his heart is young. I thought that was a kind of an interesting line, considering that the Doctor, you know, at that time is kind of in one of his older forms, but eventually will be a much younger man. So I thought that was kind of fitting.
Yeah. Nice little touch.
So Adam, you had mentioned the whole thing about the plant. The Doctor was tricked into giving this warrior a plant that he could scratch Ian with. So when they fight, it'll actually make Ian sluggish. So it was kind of interesting to see hand-to-hand combat for Ian. I don't think we've gotten that yet, other than maybe Ian versus a Dalek.
Which was hand to, plunger. Not hand-to-hand. Yeah, hand-to-plunger combat. Yeah, it was, I mean, it's a fun part of the story, because it's like, okay, Ian kind of just steps up to bat and he's going to try to challenge this guy for command of the Aztec armies, and Yataxa wills it and all that jazz. And then kind of see the fight that takes place, and Ian's just kind of messing with him to start with, and uses, as you mentioned in the opening, the magic thumb trick that knocks out the other guy. And then it kind of escalates from there, and crazy guy Frank the Aztec calls for blood, and yeah, so the whole poke of the finger and sluggish in battle. And then Barbara again steps in and saves the day.
Yes, she does. I thought it was kind of cool they show Ian kind of kicking some butt. You know, he was pretty much controlling the fight until he got scratched. And then even, I guess we can kind of jump, you know, kind of toward the end when they have to face off finally before everyone escapes. You know, Ian kills the guy. You know, he does some kind of cool little flip kick thing and flips him right off the edge of the temple. So it was kind of like, oh, wow, they're kind of giving us this, you know, kind of macho version of Ian that we haven't really seen yet, where he can kick somebody's butt if he wants to.
Yeah, he's got some really James Bond style moves, I feel like, going on. And it just kind of granted, I haven't seen the older episodes you guys have seen, but knowing that he was a teacher and not knowing anything else was background, I wasn't expecting that at all. So that was a pleasant surprise to see that he was capable of taking care of business with just his thumb.
Yeah, and it's interesting because this warrior that he's fighting is apparently, you know, their best warrior. So it doesn't say much for this Aztec tribe that their best warrior got beat by a school teacher.
I mean, Ian did have some pretty good fights to kind of get warmed up, because they pretty much fought in slow motion for the first two battles that they had. Now, the last one, they did move at a little bit of a better pace, but I think by that point, Ian was able to kind of pace all the other moves of the warrior and kind of get a good feel, because they were moving really, really slow in some of the first fight scenes that we see Ian in.
Let's jump ahead a little bit to the part where the Doctor discovers this alternate entrance into the temple, because the whole point of this episode is they come to the tomb. They leave the tomb and then end up locking the door behind them, basically. And they can't get back to the TARDIS. So the whole reason they're sticking around with these dangerous Aztecs is because they have no way out. So they're trying to figure out a way to get back into the tomb. And the Doctor finds this alternate entrance through, you know, his flirtation with this woman. He's able to get this information. So we have the Doctor and Ian who go to the tunnel. And then Ian, you know, goes inside. He's able to move the stone, go inside the tunnel. And then the warrior that he keeps beating, who he will eventually kill, tries to kill Ian by locking him in the tunnel and thinking that he's drowning him. Kind of an interesting turn of events, but then Ian is able to find his way out of the tomb, or find his way out of the tunnel into the tomb, and he's back by the TARDIS. But the problem is, when Ian leaves the tomb again, he kind of locks the door behind him again. I was kind of thinking, why didn't he prop it open or put a rock there? Or
exactly.
Like, that was, he made the same mistake twice.
Yeah, maybe all the fighting got to his head. I don't know. Because I did the same thing. I'm like, dude, there are rocks laying around. You got to be able to find something.
And he, what was the thing with the whole, he had some kind of like rope or something that he, I don't know what he thought he was going to do with it. But, you know, he tied it to something and then just let the door close. And then I guess he thought he was going to be able to just pull the rope and it would open right back up.
Yeah, like tied it to the top of the stone so that you could pull down on it and it would kind of swing the top down and open it up. I'm with you guys. It's like you could have at least grabbed the dead guy's head and used it to prop the door open or something. Like, there had to be a better way to do it other than using a 15th century leather strap.
Yeah, so that was interesting. And then luckily the Doctor, you know, knows about pulleys and such and is able to whittle very fast. So he was able to literally carve a wheel. It seemed like pretty quickly, but I guess that's one of the Doctor's skills that he's learned over his time.
And but, he is in the Peace Garden where you just sit in your rocking chair all day and whittle. I mean, it was perfect cover for what he was doing.
True.
Yes. He was just practicing. I did really like out or love. I want to call out my favorite quote of this arc was after he kind of played the lady in the Peace Garden and was all like, just came back and casually dropped the fact that he was engaged. And it's like, yes, I made some cocoa and I got engaged.
Where did you get hold of this?
My fiance.
I see. Your what?
Yes, I made some cocoa and got engaged.
Oh, don't giggle, my boy. It's neither here nor there. We must find that tunnel tonight.
I thought it was fracking brilliant. I love it.
Yeah, we typically, the titles of our episodes are a doctor's quote, and I'm tempted to use that one. But yeah, that was an awesome quote. And just the reaction on Ian's face, you know, kind of like, wait, what? What did you just say? You got engaged? Yeah, I made some cocoa and so got engaged. Good. So yeah, that was a great line. That. Classic loved. Doctor. So, yeah, so basically they're able to kind of get everybody together. There was a whole thing with Susan, you know, refusing to marry this guy, and they were going to use that as an excuse to punish her. I thought that was kind of an interesting side story, but maybe a little bit kind of unnecessary, almost like just to give Susan some screen time, but kind of a pointless side story.
Yeah, the perfect victim in and of itself is kind of a funny character. The guy who is willingly going to sacrifice himself, so for like 3 weeks leading up to his sacrifice, he's able to have everybody at his beck and call. He gets whatever he wants at any point in time. It's an interesting character to have in these episodes.
Whatever he wants, yeah. Except for Susan, because she was not having it, no matter what it meant, you know, for their safety. I thought maybe she should have played along, maybe kind of thinking, okay, I'm not going to really have to marry the guy because we're getting out of here pretty quick. But no, she was pretty stubborn about it, but good for her.
Yeah. I found her to be a little annoying.
Ah, join the club.
Yeah, that's pretty common. Yeah. If you're saying it's like, you're just kind of there, and she has a little bit of a shrill voice to me. And I just, yeah, I'm not sold on Susan.
Yeah, I think I had said in our last episode I've decided that she's my least favorite companion of all time. So hopefully she can grow as a character, and maybe I'll come to love her eventually. But as of now, yeah, I really can't stand her.
Not so much.
I'm hoping that she grows. I highly doubt that she's going to change, but I'm really hoping that something happens, because we have how many more episodes of Hartnell and Susan that it'd be rough.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm pretty spoiler free as far as what happens to these characters. So I'm not sure how she leaves the TARDIS. And it's kind of interesting, the fact that she is the Doctor's granddaughter, you know, the fact that he'll part ways with her. So it'll be interesting to see how that all goes down eventually. So did any of you, when it came down to the point where they finally figure out, you know, they get everybody together, they're going to get out of there, and you have the Doctor talking to this woman, did anybody else feel like really bad for her that he was leaving, and almost hoping that he would take her along?
I was, because I felt like, yeah, he was kind of stringing her along and using her to get, you know, as a means to an end. But I felt like there was a genuine connection there. So I'm like, oh, come on, Doctor. It's a little sad.
I'm right there with you. Like, I don't know. I kind of wanted her story to go on for a couple other episodes, or maybe her to pop up here or there. But yeah, it was kind of one of those moments where it's like, aw, he just broke a heart. The old man just broke a heart.
First of many.
It all starts somewhere.
Right. So yeah, so they get away, and that's kind of how the episode ends. There's a little bit of, at the end, they have a little bit of a conversation about how you can't change things, and those people were going to do what they were going to do no matter what. So it was kind of an interesting ending there. No real lesson learned, I guess. Other than you can't really change time, or you can't change people.
It was kind of nice to have the Doctor kind of offer up some hope for Barbara, because if I'm remembering correctly, he does mention how she didn't change the society, but she did help Otlock. She helped one person. He now knows better, even though he wandered off into the wilderness by himself with no... probably no hope for survival. At least he now knows the truth that human sacrifice is not right. So it was kind of good to see the Doctor kind of step in there, which is kind of unlike the Doctor that we have seen in the previous episodes, and kind of encourage Barbara that what she did was not altogether fruitless.
Maybe Ogluck will go off into the wilderness, come across another tribe, and then teach them that human sacrifice is bad, and then that will be the kind of the start of the change in the way that those customs are.
Yeah, and actually I do think that is part, I mean, yeah, it might be an extreme, but that is part of Doctor Who, is how the littlest change, be it for better or worse, can ripple and have a pretty long reaching effect. It's something I try to keep in mind when I get upset with them for not fixing a certain thing or not changing time or, but yeah, who knows what he taught others.
Yeah. Because when he saved the family in Pompeii, he actually saved his future self, right, Aaron?
Yes. I'm still holding to that theory until it's disproven. But yeah, so I was pretty happy with these episodes. I was very entertained. I didn't find myself bored like I kind of found myself in some of these past episodes. I thought across the board the acting was really good. The characters were good. The story was good. You know, a couple minor complaints about just, you know, some of the low budget effects. But really that's to be expected. So I was very happy with this storyline. And I hope more like this and less like the, you know, Dalek Thals episodes.
I'm right there with you. It was actually a nice little respite, a nice little encouragement, these couple episodes. It has me excited for what the next episodes hold. Maybe we've turned a corner, and from this point forward, it's going to be good stories and fun characters and great characters. I might be being a too optimistic, but it was a nice little refresher.
Yes, and for me, like, I feel like this was a good introduction to classic Doctor Who. It was a pleasant experience. I found a lot more to like than I thought I would. I found some kind of progressive characters. I didn't expect to see a companion in that age being like Barbara was. So the experience has definitely encouraged me to continue to dive into the classic Doctor Who episodes. So well, I'm really glad you had me on and got me started on that path.
We twisted your arm to watch some classic Doctor Who.
You did. Bullies. No, just kidding.
But I'm happy you liked it. Hopefully you'll watch some more classic stuff and we can have you back on the show. I think it was great having you on.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun and I would be happy to come back anytime.
Awesome. So thanks for listening to this episode of Bad Wolf Radio. As always, you can leave us a review on iTunes. If you haven't done that yet, we'd love to get your feedback. You can follow us on Twitter at Bad Wolf Podcast. Looking for some more followers over there. Facebook, have a great community going on there. If you want to jump on Facebook, leave some comments, talk to us. Me and Adam are on there quite a bit. So if you leave a comment, we'll definitely reply to you. And you can always send us feedback. Send us an email, badwolfpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, get your feedback in that way. And then, if you have any ideas about things you'd like to hear us cover, if you're enjoying these classic Doctor reviews or just any opinions at all, just let us know. And we may even read your email on the air. And until next time,
later days.